And now, the podcast about movies for people like movies. Welcome to Snubs.
We're live. We're legal.
What does that mean?
It means it's legal for us to record now.
Okay. It wasn't a minute ago.
Well, it wasn't.
What
physically
changed?
Recording before. Gotcha. Now we have, you know, devices.
Okay.
Yeah, I got it.
Are you finished checking your email?
I'll stop. Okay, let's go. Let's do it. Okay, great. 1, 2, 3.
Welcome to Snubs.
Welcome to Snubs.
Welcome back to Snubs.
Season 2.
It's very exciting. We haven't recorded in a little while, and we haven't released an episode in a little while either, because we've been busy.
Yep, this isn't our only thing that we do, everybody. We've both traveled.
What a surprise that must be for people.
Well, yeah, I mean, for most people, they hear this and they say, this is a professional
Most podcasters are full-time, right?
Yeah, that too.
Yeah.
No, but we've been busy, and we're sorry. I know we mentioned that there was going to be... Is this the way we want to start?
Yeah, it's fine. Let's just keep going.
Yeah, so we mentioned that we'd be back in 2 weeks. It's been a little more than that. So we're sorry.
Are you now deleting files on your computer? Busy. It's making a trash noise.
I wanted to make sure that none of the extra unemptied trash would slow down the recording.
Great.
It's not a lot of headroom.
Maybe we should just get back to the premise.
Let's do it.
Cool. What is it? What is Snubs?
Well, this is actually something I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
One thing we've never really done is have a codified, like, intro that we say every time.
Oh yeah, we should work on that. Should I try something right now?
I would love if you did. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are a podcast that presupposes what if the very short-lived best popular film or achievement in popular film Academy Award that was announced and canceled by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences had existed throughout history. Now, what would have been nominated and what would have won in past years? And yeah, that's all I got. That's basically the premise.
What do we think? Was that it? Was that what the intro is going to be?
No,
every
I think
time?
We should probably write it down. We got to work on it a little bit.
All right, let's work on writing it
maybe
down.
Maybe by
for
season
episode
three.
Two.
Season four.
If we get there, I'll be proud of us. I'm not convinced we'll ever do it.
Yeah, that's okay. It shouldn't be that hard. Especially since this is our full-time gig.
Yeah, I mean, come on, you guys. We should really work harder on this, right?
That's okay. Well, so we said that we were going to recap the first season briefly.
Let's do it.
Which was 1996. We chose 1996 because it was a year of a lot of kind of beloved popular films that people still talk about today.
Yep. Big year for both of our development, I think, as we were both around 12, 13.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll get back to that in a second, actually, because this next year is also a big year for us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we had Independence Day. We had Twister. We had Mission Impossible.
Ooh.
We had Scream. The Rock. The Birdcage. That Thing You Do. And there's definitely one that I'm missing. Oh, yeah. The First Wives Club and The Long Kiss Goodnight. And ultimately, we decided that Mission Impossible was the winner of the Imaginary Best Popular Film Award in 1996.
Yeah, that it made sense. It eked out a win over a few other movies, which could have maybe done
didn't really
it,
like eke
Twister.
Anything. There was just no other choice.
Well, I mean, you know, Twister was a pretty big one. It was hated upon a lot by one of us.
Which was not me.
Yeah, well, the other one. So, and you know, Independence Day, a lot of feedback I got when I would tell people the 10 movies that we picked were like, most people were saying like, oh, well, it's got to be Independence Day, obviously.
But does it?
They didn't go into it as deeply as we did unless they listened to the podcast.
Yeah. And I think that this is actually, this year that we're going to do right now, the year that we're going to start right now, is 1984. Mm-hmm. And I think it's actually a really interesting year in a lot of ways, because in 1996, that highest grossing film of the year was Independence Day. Mm. And so it would have been very easy to just pick that. Mm-hmm. And in 1984, you have a much more diverse mix of different films in different box office places that have really stayed with us for a number of years.
Talk about it.
Great. So why 1984? Why did we pick 1984? What were you doing in 1984?
Me?
Yeah.
I was, you know, just learning to, I guess I was probably having tummy time sometimes.
Oh. What does that mean?
Well, it's when newborn babies are forced to be on their stomach because it makes them, you know, strengthen their neck and spine.
I didn't know that that's what it was called.
Never hung out with a baby before?
So you didn't have a lot going on.
How about you?
I was born in March.
Yeah.
So not a lot going on for the first couple months of the year.
Right.
But, you know, then I got right to it.
Tummy time.
Yeah, tummy time.
That's sort of the first thing you do with your newborn baby if you have one.
Okay.
I mean, not the first thing. Mm. And I'm not an expert on baby rearing, so don't laugh at that.
Yeah.
Don't even. It's just a statement.
All right.
I'm not an expert.
I know that you're not an expert because I don't even think that's what it's really called.
Okay, fine.
All right. But so 1984, we were both children.
Yeah. These are movies that we did not see in theaters because mm-hmm. we were just barely born when they came out.
But it's really interesting because with the home video market and the re-release market, these are the movies that we are going to talk about this season.
Yeah.
Are the movies that are probably the most indelibly etched into my brain from my childhood.
Interesting. Well, they're kind of the movies that our parents couldn't go out and see because they were having us.
Yeah.
And that maybe they rented.
Yeah. Probably.
Yeah.
We should probably do a deep dive into the home video market at some point.
Sure.
We'll save that for another episode.
Yeah, because you know why? Because our research did not include that question.
No, it did not include that question.
But you guys, we did research. That's something that we did do.
We did. We took essentially like a 6-week break to do research, which
we waited until today.
Waited until today to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't we get into our picks for 1984?
Great.
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I'll go first. Okay, so my picks in no particular order. Start with The Terminator. Karate Kid. Sorry, The Karate Kid. The Ghostbusters. That's not what it's called. Purple Rain and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Great movies.
Thank you. I didn't make them.
Great movies, I think.
Pretty much good movies. Yeah, we got some. Yeah, we'll see. We're going to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, so the interesting thing is, you know, because these are the movies that are most kind of indelibly etched into our brains, I feel like I remember all of these, but I don't know that I've watched some of them in a long time. Agreed. And watching some of them for this podcast, I've realized that some of them aren't very good.
Yeah, it's that thing about just like iconic moments in the movies that stick in your brain, and not just yours, but the culture at large.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing about movies that become franchises, and you know, 4 out of the 5 that I picked are all part of long running franchises.
Yeah. We're going to talk about that in a second.
3 of the 4 are the beginning of those, and you know, maybe these movies aren't so great, but they have some lasting power.
That's true. So mine were Beverly Hills Cop, Romancing the Stone, Gremlins, Splash, and Dune.
Great picks.
Now, on balance, your picks are better.
Well, you're going there?
Yeah.
You're going to start saying this. Oh, you're going to lift me up before you start to tear me down.
Nope.
No?
Nope.
Okay.
I just want to put it on the record that I realize that Josh's picks are better for this season. And one of my picks, although I'm not going to retract it, is a mistake, which is Romancing the Stone, which is, I watched and
not
you watched.
Dune?
Not Dune. Dune.
What is not a mistake about Dune, though?
Dune is interesting.
Uh-huh.
Romancing the Stone is bad.
Romancing the Stone is bad. Although you told me today, I didn't realize it has a sequel.
It does. It's called The Jewel of the Nile.
I wish I would have seen that.
You know what it is? Worse.
Oh, boy.
But I think to your point, you know, these are the 10 movies that we have picked are all still with us in some way. So 3 of them are still part of continuing franchises. So we are getting Terminator 6, Dark Fate, sometime this fall, I think. Indiana Jones 5 is coming out in 2020 or 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have I think it's a YouTube original series, Cobra Kai, which is the continuation of the Karate Kid franchise.
That's wild.
So 3 of them are continuing franchises. 3 of them are right now in the process of being remade.
I mean, isn't Ghostbusters a continuing franchise in one way?
But not with the same characters.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant by continuing franchise. Mm-hmm. Dune, Ghostbusters, and Splash are all right now being remade. Two additional ones have sequel scripts. So Beverly Hills Cop 4 and Gremlins 3 apparently have sequel scripts.
Oh my God.
And so basically all we have left out of the 10 are Romancing the Stone and Purple Rain are the ones that are not going to continue with us as franchises and the culture.
As far as we know.
As far as we know. I mean, maybe they'll get Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas back to do some swashbuckling, but...
And maybe the Ghost of Prince will come back and produce a new Purple Rain.
The Ghost of Prince, sure.
I believe it. But this is an interesting time because we are, you know, this past 5 years to 10 years, it feels like every piece of intellectual property is being remade or added to as far as a sequel. And the movies that we're talking about here are kind of the fodder for that. It's people's memory of films that they remember being a big deal, whether they like them or not. They're going to go see a sequel to that movie. Or that's the thinking of Hollywood these days.
Oh, yeah. I think that if you dragged Michael Douglas back to set for Romancing the Stone 3, I'm sure somebody would go and
see
it.
I'm sure you would.
I probably would. So those are the picks. What we decided to do, because we got a little bit of blowback from our listener.
Yeah.
the first time around, that we didn't do the matchups in an appropriately analytical way.
Yeah.
And so we decided...
If you listen to our... finale episode before our undercard episode, you heard a call in by listener number one, snub bud number one, Mary.
Yeah.
Who, you know, she had some valid points about the way we did our matchups, and we wanted to try to do it better this year.
Yeah.
So what did we do?
What did we do? We did it as if it were a seed.
Uh-huh.
Seeds, which is something that they do in sports games, I think.
Apparently sports games. Sports tournaments, yeah.
Yeah, like basketball.
Well, the concept is
March Madness.
Yeah, in March Madness they do that. You take the number one seed and the lowest seed, which is another number.
Yeah.
And you match them up together instead of putting number one versus number two, because you want to save those really close matchups for the end of the tournament. The favorites. So, you know, in our case, we take the number one box office and put it up against the lowest number in the box office. That was one option. And then the middle was the middle against the middle. Mm-hmm. We also talked about doing an adjusted seed where, you know, this way it would be, you know, all of my picks go against all of Dan's picks. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at what we got.
And that's what we did, essentially. That's what we announced. Because we said it was going to be Beverly Hills Cop versus Terminator, Romancing the Stone versus Karate Kid, Gremlins versus Purple Rain, Splash versus Temple of Doom, and then Dune versus Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And then we sat down to record today, realized, didn't want to do it.
No, I don't want to. No, I don't want to knock out Beverly Hills Cop or Terminator on day one.
Exactly.
Why did Terminator get such a low seed?
Because it was number 21 at the box office.
Boom. See, there's the thing. Sometimes the box office being not so receptive to a movie really has nothing to do with its long-lasting appeal.
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, honestly, who talks about Romancing the Stone these days?
Just us.
Just us. So, we are throwing out the analytical way of doing it, and we are just changing things around, as is our... want and write, because nobody cares.
That's all right. So what are we going to talk about today?
I think we're doing Beverly Hills Cop versus Karate Kid and Terminator versus Romancing the Stone.
That's right. That'll be our first two episodes, which we're going to record today. But they're going to be in the form of two separate podcasts for you beloved snub buds out there.
Now, keep in mind, we did take a 6-week break so that we could do all this research and watch all of the movies. Again, did not. I've watched everything in the last 24 hours and have done a little bit of research today. So hopefully we will release these episodes in an uninterrupted fashion over the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, we can try.
Yeah, we can try. You know what? That's the best anybody can do.
Absolutely. So I think that we should talk a little bit about the year that we're going to be talking about.
Do it. This
Are
is
we
your,
there? Is it
yeah,
time now?
We're there. It, yeah.
This is me?
It's you.
All right, let's do it. So 1984 was a year Okay, throwing it over to Dan. Go ahead. No, just kidding. There's more to say about it. A lot happened in 1984. In technology, just to put you in the headspace, this was before the internet. You know, there was no social media. There were no smartphones. There was no surveillance, like mass surveillance and control that was predicted by George Orwell's 1984. What there was the IBM PC, which cost $3,000 in 1984 dollars. The only mobile phones available were huge. They cost $4,000, which would be $9,000 today. Other things that were around, the floppy disk, the cassette tape, Atari, the ultimate popular video game winner of today is Tetris. It's been around since 1984.
Oh. Okay, that's cool.
It still exists. It's pretty crazy. So, who was born that year?
Well, I was.
Dan was. Also, Olivia Wilde, LeBron James, Scarlett Johansson, Avril Lavigne, and Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh, well, Mark Zuckerberg is an 84.
He is.
He's a little bit more accomplished than either of us.
Yeah. He's a little more accomplished than us, but that's okay. We're getting there.
You know, I've done some things in my life that I'm proud of, some things in my life that I haven't. I never contributed to the fall of democracy in the U.S., so I guess I'm doing okay.
You got that going for you.
Yep.
Eat that, Zuck. Let's stop for an ad break.
Great, great.
All right. So one of our first major advertisers is Facebook, and that's a good service to use. Everyone, I hope that you're on it. We do not have a Facebook page. It expired because of lack of use. So go Facebook, everybody.
I wasn't really sure what you were doing there for a minute, but then I realized you were putting in place our plan, our grand plan to monetize this podcast.
Yeah.
Our grand plan to monetize this podcast is to do fake ad reads that are so bad that we will be paid to stop.
Yeah. So we'll start that after this. This was a real one.
Okay.
So what else was going on in 84?
Well, we can talk about 1984 in film. All right. You know, I wish that I had a little bit of a better thesis for 1984 in film, because I think that 1996 felt in a lot of ways a little bit more like a pivot year, where you can kind of point to changes in technology that are really affecting what's released at the box office and what's popular.
Mm.
1984... there's certain like themes that you can trace through and like around the 80s, right? So on the technology side, you have things like War Games and The Terminator and The Last Starfighter that are all sort of very interested in this idea of how technology can be a weapon and how technology can be turned against the human race and other things like that.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, a couple of sort of separate streams of films that are about like economic anxiety and and kind of individual exceptionalism, and that's like Karate Kid or Flashdance or Back to the Future, things like that, where, you know, the kind of economic anxiety and other pieces like that are popping up. But there's nothing that I can really say that sort of ties this all together outside of the fact that I was reflecting that movies used to be worse.
That's really what your thesis is? See, I kind of feel like it was just interesting to see what people were doing before there was such an ease of technology in filmmaking. You know, it was, I think movies were more story focused, to be sure.
Yeah, I
guess maybe not these movies.
Yeah, maybe not these movies.
But, you know, other movies.
I think it's just, it's interesting because out of the things that we're watching right now, there are some sort of similarities that would suggest that directors or Hollywood thinks that audiences want a certain thing, and maybe they do. And one of the things that they want are action montages, like pretty clumsily edited, poorly put together action montages.
Yeah.
Which we get in Beverly Hills Cop and Karate Kid, which we're going to talk about next.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, while there are some of these movies that I really do, you know, like a lot, and I think Terminator is actually like great, and I think Temple of Doom like has its moments, and Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop, but there's a lot of pieces of them that are very hokey and very clunky, and that sort of like wouldn't pass muster in terms of basic quality today.
Yeah, I'm with you. Maybe it's just a general movie consumer's lower attention to detail.
Yeah, maybe.
At the time.
It's interesting because the movies that were sort of most prominently placed at the Oscars in 1984, a lot of them are really quite good, although I haven't seen most of these in a while, but they haven't really stuck with us very much either. So the five nominees for Best Picture for the 1984 films, so the ceremony in 1985, were Amadeus, The Killing Fields, Passage to India, Places in the Heart, and A Soldier Story, which I don't think I've ever seen. And then even if you look at 83 and 85, it's again, it's a bunch of stuff that nobody really talks about anymore. The Dresser, Tender Mercies, Witness, Prizzi's Honor, Kiss of the Spider Woman. There's a couple of things in here like Terms of Endearment or Color Purple that I think are like kind of still with us. But for the most part, I do think that while I don't have a very clear thesis for 1984, I think our broader thesis behind this podcast, which is that the movies that would have won the Best Popular Film Award are the movies that have sort of stuck with us for the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years.
This is a great point. What won Best Picture in 1985?
Oh, sorry. Amadeus won. Amadeus swept.
Amadeus won every award, practically.
It won a lot of awards. Yeah, it won a bunch of awards. Because it got all the below-the-line stuff, too.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
It's no. We're not dealing with an English patient here.
No, Amadeus is good. I haven't seen it in a long time, but it's good.
It is interesting that none of the films we're talking about really made a dent in the Oscars. There were a couple here and there.
Well,
Purple Rain had a score.
Yeah, I have to go
back. Or soundtrack score, actually, which was a category that doesn't exist anymore, I think.
Yeah. I have to go back and check a couple of them that we're not talking about today, but like Beverly Hills Cop was nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
That's very interesting.
Fascinating. Which is weird because it was mostly improvised.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, come on. Yeah. Come on, guys.
Anyway, I have one last bullet jotted down here. Is this season going to be different?
Well, like I said, we're now monetized.
Right.
All
these Facebook ads.
We're introducing the problematic meter.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I wanted to introduce was, you know, this thing that I have. Well, I think maybe we should take breaks.
You should take breaks.
Like this. Ready? All right, everybody, let's take a break. Like that. And then we just continue.
Okay. So for everybody listening at home, for the one person listening at home, it's going to be exactly the same.
Yeah, pretty much. More of the same, you guys.
Perfect. If you didn't like the first time around, don't come back for more.
Continue not listening.
Great.
We're talking about two movies that came out in 1984.
You don't know, do you?
Karate Kid.
Yeah.
And Beverly Hills Cop.
Exactly.
Wait, is that right?
That is right.
Oh, yeah. Karate Kid and Beverly Hills Cop.
It's so iconic. It is probably the thing that I remember about that movie more than anything else about that movie.
It's just about the biggest thing in the movie. It's a character in the movie. It's a plot device. It's a set piece. It just carries throughout the whole movie. Unlike most other scores, and we're talking about, of course, the score for Terminator. Just kidding. For Beverly Hills Cop, which it has a beat to it, like drums that are playing a 4-4 beat that continues throughout the movie. Once you get to a certain point, it just starts and it doesn't stop. It may mute for a little while, but then it comes back and you feel like you're still in the same tempo.
Yep.
It really provides a lot of propulsion to this movie. Works.
I think that's right. So which one do you want to start with?
I guess we already started that one, so let's just do it.
Let's just do Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah.
Okay. Beverly Hills Cop is a funny one because in some ways it's the most important movie on this list, and in some ways, in other ways, I don't know that there's as much to say about it. So it was the number one film of 1984. It made $234 million overall at the box office.
Which is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, by 1984 standards, that's like...
20 million?
20...
20 billion?
20 billion? Is it like... It's probably worth the National Reserve.
Fort Knox?
Fort Knox, yeah. I don't know. It's a lot of money. There's a lot of different talented people involved. So this was a Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer production, which is the second one that we've covered on this podcast because we talked about The Rock during season one. was directed by a guy named Martin Brest, who has a super interesting career. He's made a very limited number of movies, but all of them are kind of known. So he made like one movie before this that I can't remember the name of. I think it's called Going in Style. But then he made Beverly Hills Cop, Midnight Run, Scent of a Woman, Meet Joe Black, and then his career tanks with Geely.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. The Bennifer movie.
The Bennifer. I forgot they were called Bennifer for a while.
It was a great portmanteau.
Did you like Meet Joe Black at the time?
No, at the time I really didn't like it.
Now you do?
No, I also don't like it now.
I liked it when I saw it on TV. I don't know why.
What's the thing? He's death, I guess.
Brad death Pitt takes is a holiday. Guy who shows up in town when Anthony Hopkins is old and probably dying soon.
Yeah.
And it turns out at the end that, yes, spoiler alert, he is death.
Yeah.
But really, he becomes a friend.
Do you think anybody really cares about Meet Joe Black spoilers at this point?
I mean, no, I don't, honestly. Okay. But I had to say it.
Okay.
All right, and we'll be back. All right, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah. Okay. So, an interesting director, and I think this and Midnight Run are two movies that are like very much of a piece with each other, because they're both sort of like buddy cop comedies. Eddie Murphy is the only person who's in this who's really kind of noteworthy in terms of talking about their career. Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's actually very unfair to Judge Reinhold. Who went on to become
is it?
A recurring joke on Arrested Development. So Eddie Murphy had already been in 48 Hours and Trading Places, and also, of course, on SNL. But this was the thing that really put him over the top and made him a real star for a number of years. And, you know, he was in the sequels to this. He was in another 48 Hours. He was in Coming to America. He had like a tremendous run of box office success, and then ended up pivoting to sort of more family friendly stuff, because he was in The Nutty Professor in the mid 90s, and then
that was kind of I felt like that was a resurgence for him.
Yeah, because there was a couple flops in there. There was like whatever it's called, Vampire in Brooklyn, some other things like that.
Oh, yeah.
But that was like, if it was the second stage of his career, it was a very successful stage of his career, because he also had Dr. Dolittle and these other movies. And then so many Shreks.
Yeah.
Can I tell you how many Shreks?
Please, I didn't realize how many Shreks there have been.
Okay. Shrek.
Good.
Shrek 2.
Okay.
Shrek 4D.
Which is the third one.
No, Shrek. This is confusing. Shrek 4D is a short, which I assume it just meant four dimensions, that came out before Shrek 2, actually.
Before Shrek 2?
Yeah.
Okay.
So Shrek 4D, Shrek 2, Shrek the Third.
Which is the third one.
Shrek 4 Ever After.
Are you kidding me?
Shrek's Eulogue, Shrek's Thrilling Tales. I think that's it.
And Eddie Murphy played.
Oh, no. Sorry. Donkey's Christmas Shrektacular.
Oh, wow. He got his own spin-off.
I guess so.
Probably without Mike Myers in that one, huh?
Probably. Those movies are the worst.
I've never liked even one of them.
Yeah. But now he's experiencing a little bit of a resurgence, because it's the craziest thing. He's revisiting some of his greatest hits, because Coming to America.
This is happening?
It's happening. It's in pre-production. And then but it has a release date attached to it.
Okay.
Triplets. So they're making a sequel to the Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito movie, Twins.
Oh.
But Eddie Murphy is going to be the third brother.
Okay.
They've talked about that forever. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen, but it's on his IMDb page.
Okay.
And then Beverly Hills Cop 4.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm curious. I'm interested. We'll have to see it. When
yeah.
it comes out, was that 2019 release? 2020? 2021? 2022?
Not 2020, tagged to a date.
We'll see.
Not sure. But, you know, I feel like if Harrison Ford can be running around when he's 75 as Indiana Jones, like we still have, theoretically, another 20 years in which Axel Foley could be rebooted.
Well, you know, good question. Harrison Ford, you know, much beloved in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And grumpy, but generally... respected.
Okay.
Eddie Murphy, I don't know if that's the truth about him. I feel like he kind of is a little prickly and maybe people don't want to
work
with
him. Well, he has a reputation for being kind of difficult to work with, or he at least had that reputation in the past, although I think that that's been sort of shed at some point. But I don't know. I mean, he's had a really interesting career with a lot of different sort of ups and downs. The family stuff ended up not working out super well because he was in stuff like The Adventures of Pluto Nash and Norbit that just was like kind of bad.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he had his sort of infamous moment in 1997 where there was a he was caught in a car with a transgendered sex worker who like died in a semi-suspicious way within a year of that happening.
Really?
Yeah, that's weird. This was his, I mean, it's a funny sort of thing to say that this was his big break because that's not really true. He had been in movies before, but this was the thing that, that thrust him into superstardom, and he almost wasn't in this movie. There were four other or five other people that were attached to this film before him.
Oh, really?
Yep. So Mickey Rourke was going to be in it.
Okay.
Al Pacino was going to be in it.
Oh, cool.
Richard Pryor was going to be in it.
Uh-huh.
And then up until 2 weeks before filming, Sylvester Stallone was going to be in it. And it was going to be much more of just a straight action movie and not an action comedy.
So when he left, did they throw out the script or did anyone?
I think it just kept getting rewritten and rewritten and rewritten. And then ultimately what we all what we see on the screen is the product of a lot of improvisation as well.
Yeah.
I guess let's do the plot.
Sure. All right.
Basically.
It's Detroit.
It's Detroit.
It's crime ridden.
Yes.
It's dirty.
Yep.
The opening of this movie is showing how like messed up the city is.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the opening of this movie is really just a 5-minute excuse for them to have a stunt scene where they destroy some cars.
But the pre-opening is they're just showing shots of Detroit, right? And it's like, you know, home. It's kind of like, you know, it looks pretty rough.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, the movie opens with him arguing with the guys in the cigarette truck, which is then hijacked.
Right.
And then they go on a high-speed chase. And this is the first moment when I realized, when I was watching this, boy, are we in the 80s. Because there is a stuntman who is clearly not Eddie Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
Who's being flung around on the side of the truck as it rolls through downtown Detroit. And then the entire purpose of that 5-minute sequence is just to watch cars being destroyed. This sort of like rock song, this propulsive rock song,
sure.
Is the score on the soundtrack.
It's all is it silly. The song? Is it the Beverly Hills Cop theme happening already?
No. It's not the song. It's like it's similar to the song
right.
that plays during the ending montage in Karate Kid.
Oh yeah.
You know, you're sure. the best.
Yeah, yeah.
The best.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's the sort of setup. Eddie Murphy is clearly a, you know, rule-breaking kind of cop, but an excellent young detective, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
His friend Mikey shows up from who has just been in Beverly Hills and shows him a paper bag full of German bearer bonds.
Yes, which I almost completely forgot by the time they got to the second act.
Right. So that is the most 80s MacGuffin that you could possibly have. I don't even know what a bearer bond is. Is that still something that people have?
I have no idea what it is.
Okay.
I don't have one.
Presumably, they're not just like pieces of paper anymore. But yeah. Who knows? Anyway, his friend Mikey is killed over the theft of these bonds. He goes to Beverly Hills to investigate. He immediately knows who killed him.
Yeah.
Because this guy comes on screen and is clearly the villain.
Well, I should say, I want to say that the scene where his friend is killed is pretty dark. It's not light like you think.
No,
about,
no,
like
no
you
he's, think of this he's movie. Executed in a pretty unpleasant way.
Yeah.
So Axel goes to Beverly Hills to investigate. He meets his old friend, Jenny Summers, who is working, managing an art gallery for the villain, who is an art dealer slash drug dealer slash German bearer bonds dealer. And then the rest of the movie is basically him just figuring out how to prove the guy killed his friend.
Yes, the villain is kind of like a moral figure, according to everyone in Beverly Hills. His villainy is kind of a secret, right? He's a big philanthropist.
Sure, it's the craziest thing because he's like clearly a villain.
He's obviously evil.
He's obviously
These people
evil.
Are blind.
Yes. It's this very... I was wondering about this. So the actor that they cast, whose name escapes me right now, but he has sort of like a bump in the middle of his forehead.
He does.
He has like a villainous bump. And we were always debating whether they added that, like, to clearly identify him as the villain, or whether he just, like, had that and they cast him as the villain. But either way, it's clear that he's, like, a pretty bad guy. Axel teams up with a couple of detectives from the Beverly Hills Police Department. Uh-huh. They get up to some antics. There's almost no plot in this movie whatsoever.
There's sort of a loose thread of him chasing down the killer and uncovering the evil and the
loosest thread.
Well, but I mean, he shows up in the office of the bad guy within 2 hours of showing up in LA.
Yeah, he just goes and he talks to the villain a couple times, and then he goes to a warehouse and like figures out that there's drugs there.
Yeah.
It all builds to his friend Jenny being kidnapped and taken to Victor Maitland's mansion, where there is a like very long 20-minute sequence of a shootout with all of the different principal characters at the end. It's great. It's short. It's breezy. It works really well. It's very funny. It's mostly Eddie Murphy having the ability to just do a variety of different sort of sketch characters.
Yep.
The whole way through.
Yep. And that's how he makes his way through this world in Beverly Hills, which I guess to him coming from a quote real city like mm-hmm. Detroit, showing up in Beverly Hills where everything's kind of fake and glossy and he can kind of get around by using some tactics, some just, I mean, like you said, he's doing sketch characters.
Yep.
It's pretty funny. This is where the movie takes off.
Yep. And he teaches his friends in the Beverly Hills Police Department, who include Judge Reinhold, and I forget what the other gentleman's name is, the other actor's name.
But it's John Ashton.
John Ashton. So it's Taggart and Rosewood.
Yeah.
And basically, he gets them to loosen up a little bit, and they realize that he's a very good cop.
Yeah.
And everybody's friends in the end.
Everybody's friends in the end. Yeah, they send him back to Detroit, and they don't tell his captain.
They don't tell, yes, Lieutenant Todd or Inspector Todd or whatever it is.
Yeah. So, you know, the moral of the story is, hey, cops, don't be so held down by rules. Just sort of go with your gut and do whatever you want to do.
Not a message that we at Snubs endorse.
It's a very strange, it's a very, very strange final message for the end of this movie, looking at today's world.
Yeah. Yeah. You could not make this movie today in a lot of ways.
You know, I don't know. I think they do a pretty a decent job avoiding the problematic-o-meter on this one, but that's one place where they don't.
Yeah, they don't. I mean, the other thing that's kind of that is kind of problematic in this movie is Serge, who's played by Bronson Pinchot, mm-hmm. who is the I don't know what his role would be, but sort of like the he's the gay assistant at the art gallery where Axel Foley's friend works, and he's very much a caricature. On the other hand, he's very funny.
He's funny, and you know, you get the feeling that he has a fleshed out character in mind.
Yeah, that's the thing. So, you know, we talked about how angry I was at the Rock and about the character of the gay hairdresser,
yeah.
who was brought in for like what could only amount to the most minor of laughs because it's just not funny. It's yeah. kind of a crappy caricature.
Yeah.
And I think it's really because it almost completely lacks any specificity.
Yeah.
Whereas Bronson Pinchot clearly has a whole thing in mind with this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he comes back for Beverly Hills Cop 3.
And he deserved it.
He did deserve it.
Yeah. So he's all right. He gets past the meter.
Yeah.
There's a lot of race stuff in this movie, but they don't really... And maybe the problem with this movie is that they don't address it.
Yeah, they don't really. I mean, they do it in some minor ways, like where... Eddie Murphy is thrown out of a plate glass window at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And he's arrested because right. he's in Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
And there's stuff like that that's sort of addressed kind of under the surface, but not in any real sort of meaningful way.
Yeah.
And I wondered about this a little bit because I don't really know whether this would have been an issue or not, but the kind of semi-romance with his friend is not really fleshed out very much at all either.
But which one? What do you like? The friend who works at the gallery?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They have a romance?
Yeah, I mean, like, you wonder if there were rewrites from Sylvester Stallone to Eddie Murphy. You know what I mean?
Gotcha. Like, as in they cut out a romance.
Exactly, because one of the things that I read and some of the research that I was doing was that originally that character was supposed to be the romantic lead for Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. Yeah. And in this, they're just friends.
And just, yeah, exactly.
He doesn't cross any lines with her.
Yeah.
No jokes about anything with her.
Yeah, exactly. And so there are some things where it does feel very much like a completely different cultural moment. But a lot of them are kind of glossed over because ultimately this is a very much a big budget comedy.
Mm-hmm.
That's not particularly interested in any sort of serious issues.
Now, it is interesting to point out, I think, that the fact that it's remembered as a big budget comedy, but tonally, it doesn't feel like a comedy at all until,
really?
Not to me, not until it gets to Beverly Hills.
Oh, yeah. So in the first like 20 minutes or so, it feels very much like a drama.
Like because, a cop drama.
Yeah.
And then his character comes alive and is the funny mm-hmm. in the movie. There's nobody else acting funny. There's no, like, even Judge Reinhold is a comedic actor.
Yeah.
Doesn't have any comedic lines in this film.
Yeah. What is the thing that he is in Arrested Development? He has a...
It's a courthouse show like Judge Judy. But they keep changing the name because he doesn't want it to be called Judge Reinhold's. They call it Mr. Reinhold's Courthouse. With William Hung and the Hung Jury. Remember William Hung from American Idol? Or no, America's Got Talent, I think.
Yeah. Yes, I know. I forgot
it's
about that.
It's a good joke.
Yep, that is a good joke.
I think it's just one episode, actually, where they keep on...
No, because I looked at... I looked this up on YouTube, and there was at least like 3 minutes of Judge Reinhold-related clips that were on Arrested Development.
Mr. Reinhold's Courthouse will always make me laugh.
So this movie spawned a number of different other pieces, another number of different sequels and other pieces of media. So Beverly Hills Cop 2 came out in 1987. And I couldn't remember this. I was like, why does he keep going back to Beverly Hills? And so in number two, Lieutenant Bogomil is shot and Axel flies to Beverly Hills to figure out who did it. And then in Beverly Hills Cop 3... his boss in Detroit, Inspector Todd, is killed. And then for some reason, the person who killed him owns a theme park in Beverly Hills, and so he has to go back to Beverly Hills. there was a... I wouldn't call it a reboot. There was a sequel of sorts in 2013, which was a TV pilot. It was going to be a Beverly Hills Cop TV show. It was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld.
Okay.
And written by Sean Ryan of the Shield.
Oh, wow.
And it was going to be about Axel Foley's son.
Oh.
And they filmed a pilot that Eddie Murphy is in. And this has never seen the light of day because apparently it was so bad.
Gosh. Yeah, it sounds horrible.
Yeah, it does sound horrible.
What channel was that going to be on? Was that an FX program?
I don't know. I'd have to look back and see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, tonally, it would have been dark, I would say.
Well, yeah, I can't imagine the showrunner from The Shield
making
Beverly Hills Cop, but...
Yeah.
And then Beverly Hills Cop 4 is listed on IMDb as announced, and so we'll see where that goes, if anything.
Maybe by the time we finish this season of Snubs,
maybe
we'll have Beverly Cops 4 to go
in 2021.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Whenever
right,
it comes
cool.
out.
I like this movie because it's kind of fun and breezy. And it's a great showcase for Eddie Murphy's talents. And I did pick it because it was I think it's a fun movie and it was the number one of the year.
Yeah, and it has a lasting memory in our culture.
Yeah, I think so.
The fact that there was a TV pilot that was in 2013, that means something. That's 30 years later.
Yeah. I mean, we trade on all this IP years on because it's easier than coming up with things that are new. But you know, I have to say, I do like this movie in a lot of ways. I didn't love it. I didn't love it in the way that I remembered loving it as a kid, for sure. I just watched it and I said, you know what, that was a pretty good buddy cop movie.
Yeah, I agree. It just moves.
Yeah.
For Breaking Bad fans, the hitman in the movie is played by Jonathan Banks.
Yes.
A much younger Jonathan Banks.
Much younger Jonathan Banks.
What's his character's name in Breaking Bad?
I don't know, because he's on Better Call Saul, too.
Mike.
Sure.
Sure.
I How did you Mike. Get from J to Mike?
Because I thought his name was Jonathan.
Jamike?
Jamaica?
Okay.
Yeah. So, but that's fun to see. He's, yeah. He's chilling.
Yeah, I guess so.
No, he is. He's scary in this movie.
Mm. I thought so. I thought you meant like he was relaxing.
No, I don't mean he's... That would be chilling, Dan.
Okay, all right. There's no G at the end of that. Sorry. I thought that you cut off the G at the end.
I mean, he was chilling pretty hard between this and Breaking Bad. I don't think he really did much else. Did he?
I don't know.
Did he?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
What works or doesn't for you about this movie?
You know, the main message of the film being cops should loosen up. I don't love that.
No. I feel like if you made this now... Axel Foley would be in the reverse position where his the benefit that he brings to the police department would be maybe you should follow rules more.
I mean, what the first thing that happens to him when he gets to Beverly Hills is he gets carted away for being black.
Yeah.
And then the end of the movie is him telling all the white cops that they don't need so many rules.
Yeah. It's not a message that resonates today.
We got problems. This is on the problematicometer. What's our
100%
rating?
Is. Oh, I don't know. I don't want to assign a number to it. Like, it's bad.
Oh, it's just... It has a meter presence?
It has a meter presence.
Okay.
Because, you know, I would have to think about it in relation to all of the other movies.
Oh, okay.
You know, and I don't... I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm going to give it a 5.
Okay. That sounds right.
Okay, cool. Enough said. Yeah, but I still enjoyed it. I mean, it was a fun movie, and like I said... I really think the score helps. It just kind of keeps on moving, and it's a fun movie.
Yeah. You want to talk about Karate Kid?
Oh, do I?
Okay. Let's hear it.
Okay, cool. Well, this is a movie that came out in 1984.
Okay.
My memory of watching this movie is very hazy, but I definitely saw it as a kid, and I definitely did some karate stuff throughout my life.
You did?
Because of it. Yeah, I took a karate class for a few years.
Really?
I did. My teacher's name was Tom Bruno.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, Tom, if you're listening, thanks for teaching me.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, sure. He's a fan. I never got past the white belt, which is the first belt you get in karate, taught by Tom Bruno.
Okay.
But I did have fun. You're barefoot. Did you ever do any karate?
No.
I think there are a lot of people who did karate because of the movie Karate Kid.
Okay. Not
me,
though.
Do you think so, though?
I guess.
He guesses. Great. Okay, good.
I don't know. That's like, it's kind of a, it's hard to assign motivation for how parents shuffle off their kids to extracurricular activities.
I believe the motivation for me doing karate is that it would make me fall down less and have like better balance.
Did you fall down a lot?
Yeah, I was a very clumsy child.
Oh, okay.
I don't think karate's what fixed it, but
cool. So this is why you picked this movie.
Because I fall? Because
no,
I used to fall.
You had a karate connection.
No, I did some karate. I wouldn't say it was a huge part of my life.
Okay.
But I did enjoy it.
Sounds like a huge part of your life.
I think the real reason I picked Karate Kid is because it just seemed like kind of a shoo-in for this category. I mean, there's been so many sequels and reboots, and it was a very popular film at the time. Where was it in the box office? Do you have that up?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it was number 5 at the box office.
How much money did it make?
It made $90 million, which is less than Beverly Hills Cop's $234 million. But
ooh, yeah.
Karate Kid doesn't seem like an expensive movie to make.
True. Yeah, not so much. Not a lot of effects.
Yeah.
Couple stunts. Not too bad, though.
Maybe that shower costume that they made for him. That was the most of the budget.
The scene where they drive across the country,
mm-hmm.
that probably cost something.
I guess so.
Because you have to shoot in different parts of the country, so you got to go to those places.
Do you think that they had Randy Heller and Ralph Macchio just drive across the entire country?
Well, no, but there was a car.
With a second unit crew.
There was a car. That sure. had to be transported.
Okay.
Probably just the director driving it across the country.
Okay.
But anyway, great movie. Case closed. Just kidding. So this movie was directed by John G. Avildsen, a director who we know and love.
Do we?
No, I've never heard of him before. He directed The Karate Kid, but he directed 29 movies starting in 1965.
Do you know
really, 1969?
Yeah, but I mean, you know what his big movie was.
Was it The Karate Kid?
It was Rocky.
Ooh, Rocky! Oh, did you know this guy before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Dan's smarter than me when it comes to movies. He had a big hit with Rocky, obviously. Came back almost 10 years later and did The Karate Kid. And then The Karate Kid Part 2. And then, eventually, The Karate Kid Part 3. This is what I'm saying. This movie has a lasting cultural legacy. In large part for me, the memory I have of it is what seems like an epic scene at the end of the movie. In the tournament, Danny learns the crane kick and uses it to, because it's indefensible, as Mr. Miyagi says. Turns out, watching that movie, that scene lasts about, 4.5 seconds?
Boy, what a snooze this was.
Yeah, it has a lot of build-up to that moment.
This is a long movie.
How long is it?
It is over 2 hours long.
Wow.
It's about 2 hours and 10 minutes long, I think.
Jeez.
And I kept an eye. I told you this before.
Yeah.
When you watch movies using the Prime Video app on PlayStation... Uh-huh. You can use the little joysticky thing on your PlayStation controller to just jump forward 10 seconds.
Yep.
And so I watched this for an hour, and then I just started jumping forward 10 seconds at a time.
Okay.
And it was just set up.
Yeah. Montage.
Yeah. They do not get to the tournament until like an hour and 50 minutes into the movie.
Yep.
And the final fight is not until the last 60 seconds of the movie.
Yep. You gotta say that's weird pacing.
Yeah, it's weird pacing.
Even within the tournament, there aren't too many cutaway scenes where they're talking about what's happening. Mm. It's just kind of, you're watching a few fights. It's actually a little confusing by the time you get there as who's winning and who's losing, you know?
Yeah. It is a movie that technically has three acts, right? The first act is he moves, he establishes himself, he incurs the wrath of, I can't remember the guy's name, but the... Blonde bad guy from Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
Second act is he trains with Mr. Miyagi and learns karate for the tournament. Third act is the tournament. But those things are so skewed in terms of their overall representation on screen time that basically this movie is like 60% all first act.
Yeah.
Like I wasn't even sure where it was going until like 60 or 70 minutes in.
Mm-hmm. So second act begins when they announce the tournament.
Yeah, I think so. They like agree to the tournament being the how they will settle their differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, there's a lot of setup. There's a lot of scenes of Danny being a plucky kid who can't seem to make friends and who wants to be with this girl, but, you know, her ex-boyfriend is a jerk. That happens for a very long time.
Now, in his defense, these other children are murderous.
Yeah, they're real bad.
They like almost kill him on a couple of different occasions.
They have a pretty severe lack of regard for his life and safety.
Yeah,
that's clear.
Yeah,
they don't think of him as a schoolmate or buddy. He's just the enemy, and that's probably because of their evil sensei.
Yeah.
Now Danny does not have an evil sensei. Danny has a good sensei.
Okay.
Mr. Miyagi, do you remember this character, Dan?
I do. I just watched it yesterday.
It's a big thing. Well, so he is another big iconic character that you get from this movie. I would say the final crane kick, the montages, and Mr. Miyagi as a whole are the cultural things that last after this movie. How does this movie do on the problematico-meter, Dan?
I think I hesitate to assign number ratings to these things because I think that all this needs to be taken in context, and it's hard to like compare different kinds of like racial bias and racism on film.
Yeah.
This to me was pretty problematic, and when I was watching it, I was like, I don't like this. And even though Mr. Miyagi is obviously set up as his mentor and as a hero, and the sequel takes them to Japan to learn more about Mr. Miyagi's life.
Yep.
it felt a little bit too caricaturish for my liking. And I don't think, I guess the litmus test is, if you made this movie again, would you make it in the same way today? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that there's any possible way that you would make it in the same way today.
He's kind of Yoda-ish. He's kind of a caricature for sure.
Yeah.
He's memorable. I think there's one scene that kind of saves it a little bit, and that's the scene where he tells about his family that he lost while he was fighting in World War II.
Yeah.
But it's probably not enough backstory.
No. Yeah, I don't think so.
It's on the meter, folks.
Yep. It's on the meter.
Are we qualified to talk about this stuff?
I think that as long as we are, you know, open and honest about it and are clear about our own blind spots, I think it's fine.
Good. Let's do that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the truth is, like, this is how should I say this? It's such an unusual thing to see a movie when you're a child and be not, you know, kind of politically or socially aware at all,
yeah,
and have that impress upon your memory, and then to revisit these same memories and pieces of media and whatever years later and just see how troubling it was. Like, I was really bothered by the fact that I liked Romancing the Stone when I was a kid, mm-hmm, because I watched it the other day and I hated it. I thought, mm-hmm, it was horrible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, you know, there's, I think that we can only hold so much against ourselves for when we were children, though. And I think, yeah, that we're pretty clear about it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, we're saving the youthful versions of ourselves by recording this podcast.
Okay.
Is that what you said?
No.
That's what Dan was just... Okay.
That's definitely not what I said.
Okay, let's take a break.
Great.
And we're back.
Were you going to do another fake Facebook ad read?
Oh, no, we have another sponsor, though.
What is it? Is it MySpace?
This is a product that I use as much as humanly possible.
Oh boy!
When I'm going around doing my thing, buying items.
Okay.
I use a very specific. Do I pull out my credit card? Do I use cash?
Oh, yeah! You used this earlier today.
It's called Apple Pay, everybody. It's a new thing. It's a new company, Apple Computing. They're on the market, and
what market are they on?
They're on the. I'm not sure if they're publicly traded.
Like,
if that's
the internet?
What you're asking. They're on the scene.
Okay.
They're at the market.
Okay.
If you go to the market, you can touch your phone, mm-hmm, to the little reader, and guess what?
What?
It pays.
You get it for free?
It's amazing. I haven't worked out the financial part yet, but hey, guys, use Apple Pay if you want to be fast at paying. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Oh, great. Do you have like a list of things in your head that you want to do ad reads for?
Now we're at the end of it. That's not the only product I want to do a read for.
Well, you have like 15 boxes of Think Thin protein bars downstairs, and so I think that's probably what we should do next.
Oh, I like those.
Yeah.
They're good for you.
That's fine. Let's save it for the next one.
We will. Think Thin hasn't sent that check yet. That cease and desist check order.
What else do you want to say about Karate Kid? What do you like about it or not like about it, or do you just like the feel of it, or what?
It's just kind of crazy to me that it sticks out so much in our memory, despite being kind of boring.
Yeah.
There's just little things about it. You know, there's got to be something about it that is a reason why it has that. Like, it has had Karate Kid 2 come out a few years later. It had Karate Kid 3 come out 3 years after that. The next Karate Kid came out in 1994 with Hilary Swank. There was an animated series in 1989, The Karate Kid. There was a remake called The Karate Kid in 2010 with Jaden Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then there's a television series out currently called Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
That Ralph Macchio is in.
Mm-hmm.
So listen.
But it's not about him. It's about Johnny.
Johnny.
Yeah.
That's the guy's name.
So stuff like this is really interesting to me,
mm-hmm,
because I suspect, and I did not go out of my way to watch Cobra Kai before we recorded this.
You mean it was right in front of your face and it was easy to watch?
Yes, that's true, because I could theoretically check it out at any time
on
my computer.
What is it on YouTube?
I think it's on YouTube.
That's strange.
But I didn't because I wasn't super interested. I have heard from folks that it's actually really not that bad, and that in some ways it's actually pretty good. And so the thing that's interesting to me about this is that it is a presumably a salvaging of Johnny's character from the first Karate Kid, who was like really totally reprehensible. And it recontextualizes his story and Danny's story, you know, 20 or 30, or rather 30 years later in the context of the rest of their lives. And so it's this sort of interesting narrative trick where they did the same thing with Terminator and Terminator 2, right? You took a 7 or 8 year break.
Yeah.
And then you come back with a sequel that almost completely recontextualizes the characters in a way where you have to reflect differently on the first movie.
Okay. Except in this case, it was like a 30-year break.
Yeah, but I just think that that's interesting. I think it's interesting when they're going to do it again with Terminator, with Dark Fate,
right?
And bring back Linda Hamilton's character again. I just think that it's an interesting kind of narrative trick to generate some greater level of emotion and engagement just by waiting. Just by leaving a story on its own for some number of years and then resurrecting it with the same characters and the same actors, because you can have the, you know, faces of those actors just by virtue of having age telegraph so much that you wouldn't be able to do with a sequel that's only 1 or 2 years later.
That's a great point, Dan. I mean, that's the strongest argument for the franchise and sequel and reboot heavy world we're living in that I've ever heard.
Well, so I don't really... So, I mean, this is a separate conversation, but I don't really mind the franchises and the reboots as long as they're good. Like, I mind stuff like Independence Day Resurgence. I mind the fact that there's, like, 20... Transformer movies. That stuff isn't good. But if you do it really well, then it just becomes about a story that lasts for longer than you might expect.
Well, it's finding a creative angle in a commercial endeavor, which is the commercial endeavor is, like, you know, the thought that these sequels and reboots make a lot more money than creative new ideas. I would love to see new ideas, but as long as we're dealing with the world we're dealing with, might as well do some creative takes on what we have to do.
Yeah, and I don't really mind that stuff as long as it's done well, because it's just, there's different ways of deriving narrative pleasure, right? Like, you can derive narrative pleasure from the ways in which different characters end up in relation to each other, like at the end of a movie. Or you can derive some pleasure from how those things change after years and years and years and multiple sequels and different pieces of media, etc. And I think this is like, it's the same thing with the Star Wars movies, right? Like, the Star Wars movies, you're not even really... At this point, I don't think any of us are watching the Star Wars movies to see how they end quite, because I don't think that they'll... They're never going to stop making those. At this point, we're taking a lot of the pleasure to see how the characters reconfigure and recontextualize their relationships with each other. Because 20 years from now, there's going to be Daisy Ridley and Oscar Isaac and John Boyega and, like, whatever, Star Wars 15, 16, 17. That's all I got.
Good call. All right, let's take a break.
Great.
And we're back.
Okay.
So we've got two movies. They each have a long cultural legacy. Beverly Hills Cop, possibly with a fourth installment in a couple of years. Karate Kid, present day, Tube series, Cobra Kai. How do the movies stack up other than that?
Well, I mean, you know, our very loose framework from season one was, what is the commercial relevance? What is the cultural relevance? What is the sort of longevity? And I think on, you know, it's a little bit tough because it's split in a way. Like, Beverly Hills Cop was a much more successful series overall. Karate Kid has been longer lasting in some ways. But it's also bad. And so I wouldn't vote for it.
It is bad.
Yeah.
It's bad. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for the character of Axel Foley being the biggest part of Beverly Hills Cop and the reason why it works. The character of Danny LaRusso, you know, sure, replace him with anybody, it's going to be fine, pretty much.
If I had to advance one to the final five, it would be Beverly Hills Cop.
I agree.
Great.
BHC.
BHC. One of the rare instances in which we are in agreement.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's do it. So that'll make our list of the top five, which we'll debate later.
Yes. So we will have in some number of to be determined weeks, our imaginary Oscar ceremony for these movies that came out in 1984. And we will consider whether Beverly Hills Cop and four others deserve to have the title of Best Popular Film.
That's right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Okay. Thanks to Facebook. Thanks to Apple for their advertising dollars.
And also we haven't done them yet, but we should thank them too. Yeah, perfect. That's great. Play us out.
Just keep talking.
Okay. I don't have anything else to say, really.
Fade out. Apple sound. Facebook.
Okay. You're done.
We're done. Thanks.